From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, Governor Whitmer's unveiled her budget plan. Now she has to sell it to lawmakers like Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey.
My governor is a very smart gal, and she does have more experience than almost everybody I serve with. I expect to partner with her and proceed down this road.
A Michigan rabbi just back from visiting Florida shelters for migrant children.
The number of kids that are being held there, the fact that they're not allowed to touch each other, give each other hugs, even if they're siblings. I mean, these are outrageous rules in some cases that lead to the further traumatization of these children.
Attorney General Dana Nessel on handling civil suits in the Flint water disaster.
I'm working as hard as I can and as industriously as I can to ensure that these cases are being handled properly.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's program, we talk with Attorney General Dana Nessel about her office's handling of Flint water crisis lawsuits. That'll be later in the program. But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer unveiled her budget proposal yesterday, including, among other things, a 45-cent gas tax hike to pay for our crumbling roads. Here now to give his take on the governor's budget is Republican State Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirkey. Senator, welcome to Stateside.
Cindy, thank you for the first opportunity to share with you a bit, and I appreciate the time.
So the governor says no one likes to raise taxes, but if we expect anyone to invest in Michigan, we have to invest in ourselves. So you're going through her first budget proposal. Broadly speaking, do you see areas where you agree with what she's asking for?
There's a couple of areas that I can find some very high interest in pursuing to see if we can refine them to the point where we do reach agreement. Of course, there's a few areas there that, you know, are not small conflicts. So, but all in all, you know, I'm a little disappointed in some of the lack of creativity in terms of funding for roads, since she's campaigned on it so aggressively.
Let's start overall with how your caucus is responding to the budget proposal.
So, our caucus, we spent hour and a half today in caucus. Most of that discussion was on the budget proposal. And there is a strong agreement and strong consensus that we acknowledge and accept the challenge to find more money dedicated to roads. And that is not something we take lightly, and we believe that we think that the state of Michigan we've reached consensus. Two administrations now, two subsequent administrations have both reached the same conclusion that it looks like it's in the $2.6 to $2.7 billion per year for perpetuity. Additional. We believe we've already done 1 to 1.2 of that, and so that leaves us the challenge to find another 1.4, 1.5, or maybe even a little more than that. And we think we can do that without burdening people with a 45-cent increase in the fuel tax.
What would be some, because I'm sure people would love to hear ideas, because certainly that 45-cent a gallon proposed gasoline tax hike certainly caught a lot of attention. Where do we get that to, that, you know, as you say, another 1.4 to 1.5 bill?
Well, the first step was to reach a consensus on what's the target. The second step is to reach a consensus on over what time frame. The third step is to reprioritize our current spending like we've done over the last few years and squeeze as much of that out as possible. And then the fourth step, I'm not disagreeing that we probably are going to have to raise some new revenue. Yeah. But to me, some new revenue is not $2.5 billion of new revenue. Everybody's got to be honest about this. The budget that my governor proposed included a lot of new tax money, and not all of it was going to roads. And so that's the kind of thing that's why there's a three branches of government. That's why the legislature has the prerogative to propose or to adopt budgets, and that's what we intend to do.
When we talk about being creative, how creative do you feel? I mean, as you heard, ideas even kicked around in the caucus today about the roads. What kind of creativity is happening in there?
Well, I'm not going to reveal all the different concepts, but I will tell you this. I've said this the day after the State of the State, and I said it again today in a press scrum, and I mean it. I think everybody in the state recognizes that we've got a couple challenges that cannot be conveyed or kicked down the road any further, and we have yet to hear the best ideas. But one of the areas that I think we can leverage right now, and this opportunity is just gifted to us, and that is that we've not only reached critical mass on needing to ensure that our roads are properly funded, but we've also reached critical mass on reaching a consensus on we just paid too much money for our auto insurance. Now, if we prove, and I believe we have an obligation to do so, prove that we can save people money first, then I think the conversation of asking them to spend more money on things as important as roads will be a much different conversation.
Senator Shirky, the governor proposes a repeal of the pension tax, partly to help retirees with that proposed gasoline tax, and replacing it by restoring that 6% corporate income tax on mostly privately owned businesses, S-Corps, LLCs, partnerships, so smaller businesses. The governor also told Crain's Detroit Business she'd be willing to do some horse trading with that proposed business tax hike in order to get that gas tax at the pump. So let's talk about horse trading. Is there room for common ground and negotiation on a tax increase?
Well, you know, first the fairness tax. Some people refer to it as a pension tax. I choose, and I believe I can defend calling it a fairness tax because that's precisely what it is. And then the that in combination with the corporate income tax notion for the entities in our state that create the most jobs, that provide the most innovation, and establish the fabric for most of our communities. I think doing both of those things is a going back in the past, doing practices and budget gimmicks that have proven not to work, and I have framed it doubling down on stupid. And so we're simply not going to do those. We're going to continue to make our tax structure as simple and as broad as possible. We are not going to make Michigan less attractive to capital investment. And so for that reason, those two ideas, there'll be no horse trading on those. Those are simply things we'll have to agree to disagree on.
Why fairness tax? Why that? Explain that phrase.
Well, let me put it in this context. I have a son and a daughter who live in a community. They both work. They make, in the aggregate, $80,000 a year. And they pay an income tax on that of 4.2%, just like you and I do. Next door to them lives a couple that were blessed to work in state government, retired in the mid to late 50s with more income than my daughter and her husband. And because of state law, somebody decided they shouldn't have to pay any income tax. That does not pass the fairness test. I'll put it even more bluntly. Those people, God bless them, who have worked in jobs that were blessed to have a defined benefit pension versus those folks who worked their entire lives just as hard and scraped and saved to be able to live in retirement, I don't think they should be treated differently from a tax standpoint.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Michigan Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky as we go through some of the points of Governor Whitmer's proposed budget. Let's talk schools. The governor's looking for one of the biggest increases in K-12 funding in a long time, $507 million, with a $180 per pupil hike for school districts now at the bottom of the funding pool, $120 per pupil for schools at the higher end. How do you feel about those requests?
Well, we started off this conversation, you asking me, were there areas in the budget that I was intrigued with or thought we could find some common ground on, and this is one of them, and that is where she has identified that there are some schools and some classes and some kids that require more funding than others. And, you know, for a long time, we have essentially been a state where we treated each pupil the same and therefore funded such, but we now know that there's material and significant differences, and so there needs to be a contemplation of providing funding where it's needed for those who need it the most. And so I thought she was pretty creative and sensitive in including that in her budget, and so I'm looking forward to working with her on that.
The state's budget director says that Michigan's budget hasn't grown in 20 years. Is that acceptable?
Well, You always find what you're looking for, Cindy. You always find what you're looking for. I can take a data set, and somebody can challenge me to go find the ability to prove some point, and I will take that data set, and I will find a way to prove that point. The fact of the matter is, when somebody makes that statement, they tend to just conveniently forget that we went through a few years of damn tough times. And so when you, just like the stock market, if you've got money invested in the stock market, a 25% loss requires a greater than 25% gain just to get back to even. And people kind of forget that when they're comparing data. So,
if the state's budget hasn't grown, but expenses have, it might seem there's not a lot of room to argue there's fat to be cut or waste or fraud or abuse that can be mitigated to find $1.4 up to $2 billion extra a year for roads, is there?
Cindy, that statement that they made was talking specifically about general fund. And if you just look at it on the surface, you could conclude that it hasn't grown. But what's missing in that calculation, what's missing in that assessment, what's missing in that explanation is legislatures for a number of years, at least 10, have chosen to take money out of the general fund and restrict it for purposes that we believe were the highest priorities for the state of Michigan, like roads. And so that should be credited back as net general fund for the comparison purposes that you're talking about, but it's never done. It is a statement that you can say is correct based on an incomplete analysis, but it is not a correct statement if you include all the kinds of things that have been done over the last few years to frankly address priorities.
Senator Shirky, I want to talk process because now it's going to be time for the back and forth between the governor and the legislature to come up with a budget. And for the last 8 years, we had a governor who had to learn this process and learn political negotiations as he went along. He never held elected office. Now you've got a governor who spent years in the state house and the Senate, understands the process and knows the rope. So what are you expecting this process to be like working with Governor Whitmer?
My governor is a very smart gal, and she does have more experience than almost everybody I serve with. And so I expect her to help. I expect to partner with her and proceed down this road. I believe at the end of the day, Cindy, we in general have the same long-term goals and hopes and dreams for our state. We just may have a little different paths to get there. And I'm committed to making sure that we find the narrowest differences in our paths to do so.
Michigan Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky, thank you for spending time with us on Stateside, Senator.
You're welcome, Cindy. Thank you.
Up next, we dive into the life of one of Henry Ford's most important mentors. Our weekly look at Michigan history is up next. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's Wednesday, and you know that means it's time to talk our state's history with our partners at the Michigan History Center. It was late evening, March 6th, 1896. Inventor Charles B. King climbed into his horseless carriage, fired up the engine, and drove from St. Antoine to Jefferson and then turned north on Woodward Avenue, hitting a top speed of 7 miles an hour before the battery died. The 28-year-old King thus became the first person in Michigan to design, build, and drive an automobile. Here now is the state archivist from the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Mark, welcome back.
Great to be back.
And from the Henry Ford Museum of American Innovation, pleasure to welcome the curator of transportation back to Stateside. Hey, Matt Anderson, how are you doing?
Hey, very good. Thank you.
Mark, first, tell us about Charles King's early life, and particularly, how did he come to make Michigan his home?
He was the son of John Haskell King and Matilda Davenport. He was born out west because his dad was a career military man and a successful Civil War officer. And as is often the case for those successful Civil War officers, he wound up in the Western campaigns after the Civil War. So that's why he was born out in California. And as his dad rose through the ranks in his military career, they moved back east to New York and D.C. and he was accepted to Cornell University to study mechanical engineering. And then in the early parts of his career at Cornell, his father passed away in 1888. And so we see Charles and his mother, Matilda, move to Detroit around 1889. He doesn't finish at Cornell, and he picks up a job as a draftsman in the Michigan Car Company in Detroit, which at the time was one of the leading railroad car company manufacturers in the country.
All right, then it's a very relatable story that, you know, a father dies, mother's from Detroit. All right, let's go back to where we have a base of family. And before coming up with this automobile he drove, Charles King was a pretty prolific inventor, correct, Mark?
Yeah, so he didn't finish college, but he managed to exhibit two patents at the 1893 World's Columbia Exposition. So he had one for a pneumatic hammer that was used in riveting and another for a steel brake beam. And incidentally, he's walking around that exposition and stumbles across an exhibit for a self-propelled carriage by some guy named Gottlieb Daimler.
Mm. And so Matt, take that up and pick up that thread and take us further into how Charles B. King became involved in this new thing, the automobile.
Yeah, Mark is absolutely right. He's there manning a booth at the Columbian Exposition in Chicago, where he's exposed to the state of the art and has a chance to explore some of these early self-propelled vehicles. He looks at some of the gasoline engines, and he's inspired to get into the business and try and build one himself to see if he might build an automobile. So that was it.
You know, you're telling this story, and it truly is something that you could see happening with a smart entrepreneur in 2019.
You could, yeah, and this is an example of being in, you know, just the right place at just the right time, being exposed to all of these ideas. And King was the kind of person who had the background and had the kind of personal inclination to follow up on those ambitions and make something of them.
So here we are, March 6, 1896, and he makes this drive from St. Antoine to Jefferson and then heads north on Woodward Avenue. And Matt, during that first test drive of this gasoline-powered horseless carriage, there was a very intrigued man belting along behind King on a bicycle, a pretty new invention in itself. And who was that man?
Yeah, there was a lanky fellow there with a mustache riding along, and his name was Henry Ford, who, of course, we would recognize. And Ford and King were actually friends. They had met about 1893 or so. They both frequented a machine shop near the office where King was working, and they got to talking about their own mutual interest in automobiles, and I guess you might say they're, you know, two of the first people who bonded over cars, but their acquaintance bloomed into a real friendship.
And am I correct, Mark, did Henry Ford actually kind of look at King as kind of a mentor?
I look at King and Ford, and I sort of see visions. Matt can agree or disagree, but I see Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak. I mean, and I think King's more Wozniak than Jobs. He was the visionary. He was the early adopter, and a lot of times in these stories, the person that has that vision and is inspired and does a lot of the vision work and a lot of the inventing isn't the one that takes it across the finish line. And that seems to be the case here because he also hung out with guys like Ransom Olds. So you see this mixture of him mentoring these people. Olds, you know, is credited with inventing the assembly line. Mm-hmm. Ford perfected it. And I think the same is true with some of these early automobiles. He did a lot of the early legwork, and these guys listened to him and then took it forward.
Because, am I correct, Mark, King did start his own car company, but none of us are driving Kings. We're driving Fords in 2019,
yeah.
So something must have not turned out as he'd hoped.
It's interesting because he didn't immediately start a car company. Here he was, the Daimler thing knocked his socks off, and he came back and really had a prototype ready in 1895. It just wasn't ready. Again, drives it around the streets before Ford or Olds does. But then from there, doesn't start a company. He becomes lead engineer for Olds Motor Works in Detroit, and then that plant burns, so he leaves, and then he helped design a two-cylinder car called the Northern Silent, which was made by the Northern Manufacturing Company. It was probably silent because it only had two cylinders. And then he visits Europe for a couple years to study design, and then comes back in 1910 to start the King Motor Car Company. And the company unveiled a bunch of firsts at the New York Auto Show in 1912, and he left the company that same year, incidentally taking over 40 patents with him. And then later, King Motors was absorbed by Studebaker. So maybe someone's driven a King by proxy if they had a Studebaker.
There you go. And I hate to say it, I am old enough to remember Studebakers on the road. Hey, Mac, tell us some of the innovations that Charles King gave to the American automobile.
Yeah, King always seemed to be a step ahead of others in designing and building his automobiles. The Northern had a shaft drive at a time when a lot of cars still had chain drives to the rear wheels. The left-hand steering, which was mentioned, Northern was sort of a pioneer in adopting that. The Northern had a 3-point suspension, which was also fairly advanced for the time. So he was really quite ahead of the game. And, I think Mark gets to the point, too. The King is a fascinating individual. He's really sort of a Renaissance man. He's an engineer, an architect, an artist, a musician, a writer, all of these things. The only skill he doesn't seem to have, apparently, is just business acumen. It never quite works out for him in any of his various auto endeavors.
And wasn't King's company, his car, weren't they the first with actually a V8 engine that actually was practical and worked?
That's right. Yeah, they introduced a V8 in the King in December of 1914, with just a few months after Cadillac, but the King would have been a less expensive vehicle, so you could call it one of the very first popularly priced V8s.
Well, we stop and we think about the fact that Charles B. King was one of the first people inducted into the Automotive Hall of Fame. You look back more than a century after that first gasoline-powered drive through Detroit. Matt, how do King's accomplishments hold up?
The good thing about King, even though he didn't have the success of Henry Ford or even Ransom Ohls for that matter, the fact is he did live long enough to see his achievements and accomplishments recognized. He was still alive in 1946, along with Ohls and Ford, to be celebrated in what was called Detroit's Golden Jubilee of the Automobile when they celebrated the 50th anniversary of King's and Ford's 1896 runs. So I think that's the happy ending, such as it is with the story of King. But he is rightfully remembered for his pioneering role in automotive industry, if not quite as well remembered as some of the others.
Marking the 123rd anniversary of Charles B. King's first gasoline-powered drive in Michigan, happening on this day in 1896. Great big thanks to Matt Anderson, Curator of Transportation at the Henry Ford Museum of American Innovation, and of course to State Archivist with the Michigan History Center, Mark Harvey. Always great talking history with you. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Every month, thousands of migrant children turn up at our southern border seeking asylum. Many are sent to an emergency intake shelter in South Florida, in Homestead, a shelter that's being criticized because it's the only child shelter for immigrants run by a for-profit contractor, a company called Comprehensive Health Services, put in place by the Obama administration. And according to documents from the Department of Health and Human Services, thousands of migrant youngsters have been sexually abused while being held at shelters in this country. It is unclear how many occurred at the Homestead shelter. On Tuesday, Rabbi Josh Winston of Ann Arbor visited that shelter in Homestead and two smaller Florida shelters. Rabbi, welcome. Why'd you go to Florida?
I went to Florida because I care about how our government is treating asylum-seeking children coming into this country, and whether or not they're being abused, for sure, but also just general treatment of those children that coming in here.
All right, so you were allowed in?
I was allowed in, was invited to a meeting about 3 weeks ago at Health and Human Services by the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And there are a number of us there, about 15 of us there. We had a full-day meeting in D.C. And then as a part of that, we were offered a tour of the Homestead facility and Boys Town and his house in southern Florida.
All right. Let's start with the Homestead facility. That actually had protesters outside. How much of it were you allowed to see? We're talking about the Homestead facility.
Well, I think they said that there are about 50 acres of the facility, so very little of it. But we did go on, I think, a pretty extensive tour. We went into the schools. We saw their dormitories, where the kids eat, walked around.
Able to talk to any of the children?
No, not really. We weren't really given that opportunity.
What was your sense of their demeanor?
I mean, the kids, they seemed okay, for sure. I didn't see any kids, sitting on the ground crying, that kind of thing, right? They seemed like kids. But they were kids who were being held against their will. And it isn't so much the issues of what is seen that I was worried about. It's what's unseen that I'm worried about.
Such as?
How are disciplinary issues handled at Homestead? Mm-hmm. Very evasive. I asked the director of the program there, point blank, what do you do when a kid gets out of hand? And her only response to me was that they call a counselor and they deal with it through a mental health professional. I've worked with kids. I mean, I know that there are moments, and as anybody does that works with kids, there are moments when kids can get out of hand. And to not acknowledge that there are other disciplinary means they have and that they use, to me felt like she was avoiding the issue altogether and would not say anything about what they do when kids get out of hand.
Rabbi, you saw this large Homestead shelter, and then you saw these other two shelters. Talk about the sleeping arrangements you saw.
Yeah, well, for the 17-year-olds at Homestead, it was a huge tent. I believe it was a tent, but huge room with 144 beds in there, bunk beds in there. The person in charge told us that the kids requested it, that it feels like summer camp to them, that it feels like a sleepover to them. To me, it looked like a prison with that number of beds all stacked up together. It didn't look like a pleasant experience to know that there were, you know, 143 other people. We asked how many of the beds are occupied. She said all 144. So, you know, there was that.
And how did that contrast with the two shelters that you saw, the other two?
Yeah, so at Boys Town and at his house, there were rooms that had just one set of bunk beds in there. They were all sort of home-like settings where there was a central room with TVs and things for the kids to play with. I don't love that the kids are in these situations at all, but if I'm going to choose between one or the other, I'd rather have kids in a home setting where there are people there constantly, the same person every day, they get to know, they have a relationship with. Obviously, the oversight that needs to happen. It was a really stark comparison between these two settings of what the influx shelter looks like and what the permanent shelters look like.
Earlier this month, Florida Democratic Congressman Ted Deutch released data during a judicial committee hearing telling us over 1,000 allegations of sexual abuse of unaccompanied minors were reported to ORR, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, every fiscal year since 2015. When you look at those kids at Homestead, all between ages 13 to 17, what's your sense of the kind of protection or oversight that's there for these kids? Who's protecting them?
That's a great question. This is another issue of the influx facility in particular, right? Only the folks who are charged with maintaining the facility have oversight there, as opposed to some of the other facilities which have Florida Children Protective Services, whatever it's called in Florida, coming in to inspect there. They can't go on to Homestead to do that, right? It's federal property. It's an influx facility. It runs in different rules than the rest of them.
What does that mean, or emergency influx shelter?
That's a great question, too. I mean, thanks for asking that one, right? I mean, it means that it gets to function outside of the rules. And what's sort of interesting, I think, right? So when we got there yesterday, we were told that the average length of stay now is 58 days at Homestead. But the average length of stay at, I believe it was Boys Town, is 40 days. And so you'd think that the influx shelter, the emergency situation, would be a quicker, right, release. But it's not. It's longer. And so they have fewer rules. There's less oversight in the place where the kids are being held longer, in a more industrialized nature. I mean, that is, I think, the really big, and I'm not a mental health professional, but I believe that there have been many people that have written on the issue of the number of kids that are being held there, the fact that they're not allowed to touch each other, give each other hugs, even if they're siblings. I mean, these are outrageous rules in some cases that lead to the further traumatization of these children.
Kids coming in, kids going. When they're going, where are they going?
To sponsors. That is what happens. It should be what happens. They're going to sponsors within the United States. My understanding is waiting for their asylum hearings to happen. One of the things I really wanted to mention, though, we sent HHS, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, a list of about 10 questions almost a week and a half ago. Didn't receive an answer at all for a few days, and then received a very vague answer from folks there. Questions that we'd all like to know, right? You say an average length of stay is 58 days. Okay, but how many days are the top 10% staying, right? Are there kids that have been there, as we know there have been, for 9 months plus? And how do they skew the numbers by releasing kids even more quickly, right? Are there kids that are only there for 2 days, 3 days, which obviously skews averages? So I don't care so much about averages in terms of really understanding the situation there. We need to know the top 10%, how long have they been there? The bottom 10%, how long have they been there? We asked for a trend analysis of the number of days there. They wouldn't give it to us. We asked for how many unaccompanied alien children currently in Homestead have a sponsor in the vetting process. We have no idea. Once a sponsor is identified and agrees to care for an unaccompanied alien child, what's the average length of time it takes to place the UAC with that sponsor? They wouldn't tell us. They wouldn't answer the questions. And that is, I think, it speaks as loudly as any answers would, right? That they invited us in. They wouldn't answer the questions. I asked repeatedly. We asked for it in writing ahead of time, and we got no response.
Bottom line, after having seen these shelters in Florida, seeing these kids, what do you want to know next? What do you want to do next?
I want to keep placing pressure on the federal government about how they're handling these kids, that if this truly is an influx shelter, that it should be a place that's closed down quickly. I think it's important the government have the opportunity to have influx shelters, right? There are genuine emergencies that require those things, but it shouldn't exist the amount of time that it has. It used to be that there were federal employees on the Homestead location. Mm-hmm. Those federal employees had an office there. They were moved off for a time, and they're slowly, from what I was told yesterday, being moved back onto the Homestead facility, which tells me that there's something going on there that required a change in policy yet again. There needs to be more investigative reporting about what's happening at Homestead. I hope that there are reporters following up on important issues like there were. The AP broke an amazing story a few weeks after we were in Tornillo that the people who were caring for these kids weren't even held to the same standards as the sponsors were in terms of vetting, right? That they didn't have the FBI background checks that they were expecting not only the sponsors to have, but anybody living in the house where those sponsors lived to also have. There are, I'm sure, things like that continuing to happen, and we need more people looking into it, continuing to keep the pressure on so that kids are treated well. Kids are treated properly in the United States of America, that when they come to our doors, that they are treated kindly.
Rabbi Josh Winston, Temple Beth Emeth of Ann Arbor, and an activist on behalf of migrant families, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We return now to the Flint water investigations. Now, this is confusing, so bear with us, because there are a lot of cases out there. There are the criminal cases against officials like Nick Lyon, Dr. Eden Wells, and others. We're not going to be talking about those here. We're going to talk about the civil cases. To simplify it, we're going to break down the civil cases into two groups. There are the class action lawsuits filed on behalf of the people of Flint against the state. State officials, Governor Snyder is named in many of them, for instance, as well as two private firms, the French water company Veolia and the Texas-based engineering firm Lockwood Andrews and Newman, LAN. Those companies were also involved in the disastrous switch to the Flint River. Lawyers from the Attorney General's office are defending the state against those class action lawsuits. Private lawyers are defending Veolia and LAN. But in the class action lawsuits, the state and the private companies are essentially on the same side. Then there's a separate lawsuit filed by Noah Hall, who was brought in by former AG Bill Schuette as an independent special prosecutor against Veolia and LAN. That lawsuit seeks to hold these companies accountable for their involvement in the Flint water crisis. But he was let go by Attorney General Dana Nessel last month, and now attorneys from the AG's office are leading that case. The potential problem, the attorneys defending the state for the harm it caused to the people of Flint are also the same attorneys suing these private companies on behalf of the people of Flint. Noah Hall was on Stateside earlier this week saying that he believes this poses a significant problem for Attorney General Dana Nessel.
She believes that the state attorney general's office can essentially wear both hats, represent the people who are affected, as well as the governor and the state agencies and the other folks who are responsible.
Well, the AG is with us now to help sort all of this out. Attorney General Dana Nessel, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So why did you choose to move on from Noah Hall, who was appointed by your predecessor some 3 years ago, to serve as Special Assistant Attorney General?
Well, something that I was very critical of during the campaign, and it bothered me a lot, was the fact that I saw this very lengthy investigation that, was basically being conducted by a private firm, and that firm had hired some individuals to assist. And after some, $9 million in 3 years, we saw, I believe it was a total of 15 charges or 15 defendants that were charged, half of which were misdemeanors, at a cost of some $9 million or so. And, I was not satisfied that those cases were being handled properly. And I thought it was very important that I have career prosecutors being brought in to handle this. So what I did, and I announced this at a press conference on February 21st, is that, I created, I kept in place this conflict wall. And on the criminal side of the conflict wall, in order to investigate and prosecute criminal wrongdoing, I brought in a number of career prosecutors. My Solicitor General, Fadwa Hamoud, who spent many, many years as a lead attorney at the Wayne County Prosecutor's Office, Kim Worthy, agreed to come in with us and to work in concert with our office. And, you know, she's bringing in one of her assistant prosecutors, who's the head of her public integrity unit. And I hired a number of new prosecutors to put on that side of the wall. I hired prosecutors from Oakland County, from Macomb County, from Wayne County, and also from the Prosecuting Attorneys Association of Michigan. And I thought it was very important that you have people that are accountable to this office and, frankly, aren't getting paid by the hour, so that we see these outrageous fees that state taxpayers have to pay. And quite candidly, after 3 years, you know, for all the talk that I heard on your program where Mr. Hall talks extensively about fraud being perpetrated specifically in reference to the KWA, I didn't see any charges at all that had been filed in regard to that. And, you know, 3 years is an incredibly long period of time, even for a complicated matter like this. And I thought, in order to make certain that these cases were properly investigated, properly charged, properly prosecuted, I needed to have career prosecutors who were dedicated civil servants and who were working on behalf of the people of the state of Michigan. And so that's what I did.
Now, apart from the criminal cases, the case that Noah was involved with was civil, and he wasn't taking any pay.
Well, that was a case that, again, I wanted to ensure that we had people who were directly accountable to this office. And so I am overseeing, obviously, you know, I chose the civil side of the conflict wall, and I am overseeing those cases personally. So I can tell you that absolutely I want to ensure that any companies that contracted with the state to perform services, if they ultimately, through their actions, caused any kind of harm or injury to our state residents or any financial liability to our state, that I'm going to aggressively hold those companies accountable. And, you know, there is no reason to doubt that I will do just that. I am committed to making certain that there is justice in this case, both on the civil side and on the criminal side. And, you know, there is no reason to doubt that that is true in terms of my commitment to ensuring justice.
And certainly what you say you want to see happen in this civil case against Veolia and Land is something that Noah Hall very much wanted to see. And I'm still trying to get clear on why remove him.
Well, firstly, you know, he violated numerous rules of professional conduct. You are not supposed to go, frankly, on the air, you know, onto a media outlet and to talk about an ongoing investigation. And in doing so, quite frankly, it jeopardizes those investigations and it jeopardizes the prosecutions as well. So there are a number of rules of professional conduct that Mr. Hall violated. And in fact, you know, we received a letter from a law firm representing former Governor Snyder that they intend to pursue you know, a grievance against Mr. Hall for that. And the problem is, as Attorney General of the state, all these special assistant attorneys general report to me, and I'm directly liable for anything they do. And you don't see any other assistant AGs out there talking about our cases publicly in the manner that Mr. Hall did. It's totally inappropriate. And if I can sort of give you an example, you know, yesterday I did a press conference in which I announced first-degree murder charges against Floyd Galloway, who, you know, has been charged with the homicide of a Farmington Hills woman. It's a two-year-old case. And if you notice during the course of that, you know, I talked about what we charged. I talked about the fact that, you know, I believed the evidence substantiated such a charge, but I didn't go into the evidence. I didn't go into the facts of the case because that is to be done in a court of law. And it violates the rules of professional ethics for me to in some way taint or prejudice a jury pool. And that's exactly what Mr. Hall was doing when he came on your show. And if he had concerns, certainly he could have contacted me. And it bothered me a lot that he indicated, you know, his reasons for not contacting me, which made no sense to me whatsoever. If he had concerns, he was obligated to bring those to my attention, but he did not. And, you know, I didn't pick a side of the conflict wall until February 21st. So he had ample opportunity to speak to me about that. And even if we were on separate sides of the conflict wall, it's totally appropriate to have conversations with opposing counsel. That's what we do as lawyers. We do that all day, every day. You don't reveal client confidences, but it doesn't mean that you can't have a discussion. And I actually reached out to Mr. Hall following his earlier broadcast in January, and I did not receive a response from him. So I could not allow him to continue to go out into the public sphere and to make comments which would jeopardize an investigation as well as any prosecutions.
Okay, let's talk about this case against Veolia and Land. And I guess the optics. Can an attorney who's been defending the state against civil suits and making arguments to minimize the state's role in what happened, can that attorney then turn around and also argue on behalf of the people of Flint in a different case?
Yeah, I believe that they can. And I will tell you that we went to great lengths to engage with our ethics officer in order to make certain that we were handling that ethically and appropriately. And again, one of my concerns has been the many, many millions of dollars that our state has been spending to hire private firms and to hire private attorneys that are not accountable to the state the same way that state employees would be.
But again, Noah Hall wasn't being paid, so we should point that out. But what about the optics?
He had been paid. Wait a minute. He had been paid earlier. Okay. So to say that he had never been paid was factually inaccurate and untrue.
Okay. What about the optics with the sense that we are very aware of that severe lack of trust from people in Flint in their government? Why not bring in another outside counsel to handle this case?
Well, because I wanted to be able to be directly overseeing this case, which I am. And I am confident moving forward that we're going to be doing everything we possibly can to hold this company accountable for any kind of responsibility that this company owes to the people of this state. And this has been a commitment of mine. And, the other thing that bothers me a lot, hearing during the course of Mr. Hall's interview talking about the fact that, somehow I would be a party to covering up any wrongful conduct by either former Governor Snyder or the DEQ or any other parties. I mean, I ran for this office so as to hold those parties accountable. And during the course of the 8 years that that he served as governor, I think no one was more public about insisting that the appropriate thing for Governor Snyder to do would be to resign than I was. I certainly am not going to be protecting him. I certainly am not going to be protecting any of the actions that this office, the Office of Michigan Attorney General, took prior to me being sworn into office. And it is my interest and, frankly, my passion to ensure that justice is done in this case. And it is the
and
very
now that
reason
you have
that
this,
I ran.
And now you have this case in-house. What's your sense of how you want this case to play out?
Well, I want this company to be held accountable for anything they did that injured people in our state or created a financial liability.
And if your office wins either a settlement or a trial, that award is likely to be in the tens, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars. We heard that actually when your predecessor announced this lawsuit. What will happen to the settlement money from this case?
Well, I mean, technically speaking, it should go into the general fund. But of course, my hope is that that can be utilized to offset any settlements, which, are moving forward at this point. And, I can't speak for the governor. And I can't speak for the legislature, but I have been very vocal about saying that the proper disposition of these cases is ultimately to end in a settlement so that the people of the city of Flint are properly compensated.
This particular case, in this case, the client is not the state of Michigan. The suit was filed on behalf of the people of Michigan. So is there a sense of that money needing to go to the people of Flint?
Well,
for harm that they suffered,
right,
from what happened to them?
I mean, again, I think that in terms of technically where that money has to go, I believe it does have to go into the general fund. But again, it is my hope that that money can then be utilized in regard to the settlements. That has to be appropriated by the legislature. Of course, that would be my argument, is that money should be used to indemnify the people that were hurt.
You know, if the money is not specifically set aside and used for the people of Flint and their long-term health needs, say in something like a protected trust, it just seems like the question has to be asked, what do they get out of this case? It was filed on their behalf, after all, and any money won would be because it was their public health that these private companies harmed. But if the money goes to pay off all or part of the costs that the state of Michigan incurred for also causing harm to their public health, what do people in Flint get for being harmed?
Well, I mean, I think you'd have to look at the system in general and how it works. And, of course, our office, you know, we sue entities all the time, right? You know, whether it's Wells Fargo or whether it's some other, you know, company that committed some kind of act that injured people in our state, you know, we sue those entities. And when we're successful, that money almost always goes back into the general fund. That's just the way things are done in terms of our lawsuits. There are other states that operate differently, but that's how all of our cases work here. So you could make that same argument, really, in regard to any case that is filed by this office.
If you've just joined us, we are speaking with Attorney General Dana Nessel about the civil case that's been filed on behalf of the people of Flint against the French water company Veolia and LAN, an engineering services firm that was based in Texas. Attorney Richard Kuhl, whom you appointed to take Noah Hall's place, is defending the state against these class action lawsuits. So in those suits, isn't he essentially on the same side as Veolia, also being sued by Flint residents? Is there any worry the state could agree to settle with Veolia for less money in the state suit in exchange for Veolia taking on more of the financial burden in the other lawsuits and thus reducing the state's liability, but again, at the expense of getting more money for people in Flint?
I have no concerns about that. And again, okay. I'm going to be overseeing this lawsuit. So I am letting you know and the public know that we're going to be doing everything we can to get as much as we can in terms of a settlement or a judgment in this case to make certain that you know, there's a proper amount reflected in terms of the damages that were sustained. And, you know, all I can say is I've obviously only been here for a couple months, but this is a commitment that I made to the residents of Flint and to the voters of this state. And, you know, I think to suggest that I am not going to handle these cases properly where there's really nothing to base that on, I would say is inappropriate, is improper. I'm working as hard as I can and as industriously as I can to ensure that these cases are being handled properly. And ultimately, you know, the voters will be able to hold me accountable for that in 2022 and see if I have, you know, if I ultimately have kept my promises and honored my commitment that I made to the residents of this state. And I can tell you right now, I plan to make certain that that case is pursued vigorously and as aggressively as possible.
Will there be any money, and are there conversations about this, from these civil suits set aside for future use by the people of Flint when you think of the medical care and other services looking down the road 10, 15, 20 years?
Well, ultimately, obviously, we're going to have to see what any such settlement, you know, encompasses. I would think so. I would think there'd be something that'd mm-hmm. be structured and that would take place over the course of years. And that would involve a number of different types of ways that the money is being spent. That would be my hope, you know. Now, again, I don't have mm-hmm. complete control over any of this. And much of this will have to be decided by the governor. And quite frankly, in terms of appropriating the money, it'll be in the legislature's hands to make some of those decisions. But as for me and as for my role in this, I, again, want to make certain that the residents of Flint are properly indemnified for the harm that they've suffered. And that is my goal.
And that was Michigan Attorney General Dana Nessel speaking about the Flint lawsuits. Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll continue looking at the unaccompanied migrant children applying for asylum in the U.S.
We believe foster homes are the best options for those children, that they have a family-like environment that can meet their unique and individual needs while that decision is being made.
We'll hear from the Michigan agency placing migrant kids in temporary foster homes about what action it hopes to see from our government on this issue.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia, engineered by Bob Scott. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Katie Raymond, and Laura Weber Davis. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.